KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Philip Warburg has been working on clean energy issues for 40 years. He fought the late Senator Ted Kennedy to try and locate wind turbines in the waters off of Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Warburg tells of his travels across America documenting wind energy projects in his new book called Harvest the Wind. Phil Warburg is a lawyer by training. Back in summer of 1973, he staffed one of the nation's first challenges to nuclear power in Plymouth, Massachusetts. He led the Israel Union for Environmental Defense, Israel's leading environmental advocacy group. He returned to the U.S. to become president of the Conservation Law Foundation, New England's oldest and largest environmental watchdog group. It was there he found himself in this battle with the late Senator Ted Kennedy, among others, over the Cape Wind Project in Nantucket Sound. Kind of tough. Ted Kennedy, liberal at the time, was like, wait a minute, I thought these guys were supposed to be for clean energy. And all of a sudden, you're fighting him over these turbines.
It was really quite a disappointment and a shock because Kennedy, over decades, was at the forefront of pushing for the right kinds of energy policies. Unfortunately, I think when it came to his backyard or his back ocean, he just was not willing to look at wind turbines 5 miles at sea, which was terrible disappointment in terms of literally his vision of a more sustainable energy future.
You know, the way that story filtered out here was a bunch of rich guys on Nantucket didn't want to see anything interfering with their pretty view. I mean, you probably at some level agreed with that, but was that all there was to it?
That was really the underlying animus behind the opposition campaign. It was a multi-million-dollar opposition campaign. It's still going on. The project was proposed in 2001. It has still not been built. And my frustration and, frankly, embarrassment for New England in our not being able to move a project of that scale forward was really the impetus for my writing this book.
Will it ever be built?
I think it actually will be built in the next year or two. It's surmounted all of the federal and state hurdles. There are still a few outstanding lawsuits. But I don't think they will stop the project in its tracks.
You know, there was some opposition to wind turbines in eastern Washington by some nearby residents. When you, in your travels around the country and what you know, because this is your issue, is that fairly common? Do a lot of local people oppose wind turbines when they're in their backyard?
A lot of local people embrace wind turbines because they are a welcome source of income, often in farm and ranch economies where you have cattle and grain prices going up and down, where you have weather uncertainties like this past summer, where we had devastating droughts across much of the country. Wind provides a stable source of income, so it's a welcome presence on the working landscape for many, many people in this country. That said, there are people who do not want those wind turbines in their backyards. There are some real concerns about wind turbines in terms of noise. You don't want a wind turbine too close to you, so smart siting of wind farms is a very, very important factor that wind developers need to take careful heed of, as do local and state regulatory authorities.
Then some people are concerned about the birds flying into those blades, getting chopped up.
One of the ways that the wind farms in California in the 1980s got a bad name was because they used technology that was really not well suited to bird life. The turbines were very closely sited to one another. They would spin very quickly at about 30 to 40 revolutions per minute. And they were responsible for killing a disturbing number of predatory birds, including golden eagles. That really gave wind technology a rather bad name. But if you look at the technology today, the turbines stand much taller. They spin much more slowly at about 16 revolutions per minute, and they're spaced much more generously across the landscape. So the amount of bird mortality has dropped very dramatically, which is not to say it's a non-issue. Careful sighting is important, and there are means of using radar and other technologies to make sure that wind farms are shut down, for example, if there's a large incoming flock of migratory birds.
Well, how about the old wind farms that maybe before these redesigns and placements took place? Are they still up and running?
A lot of them are still up and running. In the Altamont Range, for example, that's one of the older wind farms in California. They're in the process of replacing these older, smaller, more problematic wind turbines with a much smaller number of larger wind turbines. I think they're going from 2,400 turbines in one farm down to about 120 turbines, a dramatic drop. And it will make a big, big difference in terms of what happens to birds in the area.
We're talking about wind power. Philip Warburg has been working on this issue for a long time, got kind of frustrated with that situation on Cape Cod with the Cape Wind Project, and kind of decided to light out for the hills, travel around the country, see what was going on elsewhere. And I guess it was actually some advice that Franklin Roosevelt gave your father that he didn't follow, but you followed?
That's correct. My father was a financial advisor to Roosevelt, and at a certain point parted ways with Roosevelt over his monetary and fiscal policies. Roosevelt felt that he was not sufficiently in touch with the American people and suggested that he drive across the country, rent an old Ford, buy some used clothing, never talk to a corporate executive or a banker, and then come back and talk to him about the American economy. So my father never made that trip, but I spent a lot of time in places like rural Kansas and Wyoming and Iowa and talking to people about how different energy choices affect their daily lives.
Did you drive a Prius?
I rented cars, and I did not rent a Prius, I have to say, although I did rent some very small cars that, to the people who are driving their large trucks in places like Cloud County, Kansas, seemed like a vehicle from Mars.
Well, talk to us a little bit about perhaps one of the communities that you came across when you tried to see how wind power is actually playing out in the rural parts of America. Give us an example.
Well, Cloud County, Kansas is a rural county in north central Kansas. It was first settled in the 1870s and 1880s when the Kansas Pacific Railroad rolled through. Its population peaked in 1910 and has been in decline ever since. There is now a wind farm that has been built there, and it has brought welcome new sources of employment, both in the construction of the wind farm and in the ongoing operation of the wind farm. But the most remarkable thing that really happened in Cloud County was that Cloud County Community College made a strategic bet on wind back in 2007. It created a wind technology training program, and at the time, I think there were about five students who were interested in enrolling in the program. They leased out some classroom space between a Chinese restaurant and a pawn shop in the local mall, and today that program has over 100 students in it. People who are coming out of the Army, people who are former school teachers, people who are former office managers, people who are refugees from the construction trades, all eager to get in on the ground floor of this exciting new technology.
Now, is wind power a commercially viable enterprise? Can you make money by building a wind farm?
Yes, you can. We now get about 4% of our total power needs nationwide from wind, and that's not because of charity. That's because businesses are making smart business decisions to move forward with this technology. Some states, like Iowa, for example, get 20% of their power from wind right now. It is competitive. There is a production tax credit with which Mitt Romney made a big deal about and in trying to defeat or opposing during his presidential campaign. That production tax credit is a very important way to level the playing field between wind and other subsidized energy technologies like oil and gas and coal and nuclear. We're very used to subsidizing those technologies. President Obama tried to knock out some $4 billion in tax relief to the oil and gas industry back last spring. The Senate blocked him on that. Yes, wind farms are economically viable. Yes, they are subsidized. Yes, other forms of energy technology have long been subsidized to a much greater extent.
Now, the wind does not always blow. Hence, you have to have other sources of energy when it doesn't blow, because we're not accustomed in this country having to do without power. We have to have it all the time. So how do you deal with the fact that sometimes you're going to need supplemental power? Are you really in the long term? Do you have an advantage?
You clearly have to create a more sophisticated grid because the winds are not constant. I should mention that the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the leading laboratory, the government laboratory that focuses on renewable energy, came out with a study this past June that predicted that we could be getting half of our total power needs from wind and solar by the middle of this century using technology that is commercially available today. To do so, we would need to introduce a more sophisticated means of balancing wind with other forms of energy production technology. One interesting approach that I think could really help get us off of foreign oil at the same time that it would create a great means of storing wind power would be to build out a fleet of millions of electric vehicles. We only drive a half hour, an hour, maybe 2 hours a day at the most. So if our electric vehicles are plugged in for 21, 22, 23 hours a day, and a local utility can control when the charging of that vehicle happens and when, in fact, that vehicle can be decharged, you have a very flexible storage mechanism that is a kind of twofer in that you're getting a transformation of our transportation technology at the same time that you're getting the kind of storage you need to complement wind power.
So the batteries in all these cars, in effect, become collectively the storage medium for all this wind energy that's being generated that has to be used or stored right away. Is that actually happening?
It's not happening yet, but it is certainly technologically feasible, and people are in the know or talking about it very actively as a step that we really need to take. There are other means of balancing out wind. For example, Denmark, which gets about 30% of its total electricity from wind today, gets Norwegian hydroelectric power when the winds are slow. Mm. So when the winds are high, it actually exports wind-generated power to Norway, and Norway then pumps water into pumped storage facilities. When the winds are low and Denmark needs more power, that water resource is released, and it's a great complementarity between those two countries. We pump storage in America as well. A lot of that happens in the West. So that's another way to store power so that you can create a perfect balance between supply and demand when you need it.
And you went to Denmark to write Harvest the Wind about America's journey for jobs, energy independence, and climate stability. Now, it's a much smaller country, so they have that advantage over the United States when it comes to widespread implementation, I would think. But are there things that they are doing there that we could be doing here but we're not doing, even though we're a much larger country?
Well, first, I would actually disagree that Denmark as a smaller country has an advantage. As a large country, I think we have a huge advantage in that we have superabundant wind resources in very remote areas. If one of the complaints about wind power is that people don't like to look at the turbines, we have plenty of very remote areas where we can put up very large wind farms and not encounter that kind of opposition. So in Denmark, very frankly, I think they've developed a 21st century aesthetic whereby wind turbines are seen as an enhancement and as something that is really bringing about a transformation that should be happening. There's a Danish Commission on Climate Change that has called for Denmark to be 100% free of fossil fuels by the middle of this century. And they predict that they can do this while doubling their gross domestic product, and that they would be reliant upon wind for about 80% of their total power needs.
See, I was thinking the advantage of a smaller country is that you don't need to transport the electricity so far. I mean, in this country, we need a much more sophisticated power grid, don't we, to move the electricity around in an efficient way. If it's generated by wind turbines in Kansas, you need to get it somewhere effectively.
Although the advantage, frankly, of generating wind power in places like Kansas or places like Wyoming, along with solar in places like Nevada and Arizona, is we can develop a renewable energy infrastructure. And when the winds are blowing hard in one area, they might be blowing less hard in another area. When the sun is out in one area, the wind may be less abundant in other areas. So you can create a more complex mix that can provide a huge infusion into our electric power network. And we have that flexibility because we have a large nation.
In urban and suburban areas, you can actually go out and buy a solar panel and put it on your house. Are there any kind of local options like that for wind power, or is it always something that's going to have to be generated in unoccupied places and transported or transmitted to where you are?
Well, one further point about creating wind-generated electricity in remote places.
Yeah.
I think people exaggerate the losses that happen with transmission. If you build a transmission line, you lose about 5% of the power on that line over 1,000 miles. So you can generate electricity in Wyoming where the winds are super abundant, and you can transmit that electricity to Las Vegas or to Los Angeles with relatively small losses. So mm-hmm. I don't think that's such a hurdle. Wind is better suited for larger scale, more remote placements than, for example, solar panels, which you correctly pointed out can go on rooftops of homes, of commercial establishments, of industrial buildings. I don't think it's an either or. I think we have to move toward a more sophisticated renewable energy economy, and wind power could be a very significant part of that economy.
I've been hogging the conversation here. Maybe you've got a question for Philip Warburg, 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW, 800-289-5869, or you can write to us. Our email address is conversation@kuow.org. We've got George, and he's giving us a call today from Beacon Hill. George, good afternoon. Did you have a question for Philip Warburg or a comment?
Yeah, I do. You know, the notion that somebody other than me would be scheduling when my electric car recharges, and I drive an electric, 100% electric car all, you know, all the time, every day. It's crazy. I mean, who is going to explain to my wife that who I didn't pick up at 4 a.m. that the reason why that happened was because the grid decided that I shouldn't have electric power until 6 a.m.?
George, that's a great question that had not occurred to me. But, Philip, how do you know that you're going to have the juice in your car when you want it to be in your car if it's being used as a part of a collective battery for energy?
Well, first, this is not a system that would be imposed upon people. People would volunteer to subscribe to this system. And the flexibility is such that you would not be totally decharging your car. You would be drawing down on that battery at times when you needed to even out the bumps in the power supply. It would not create a problem for George, I don't think, with his electric vehicle. You can also have a hybrid electric vehicle. We just ordered, my wife and I, a Ford C-Max hybrid electric plug-in vehicle. And if you have a plug-in hybrid, then you're never without power. You're never going to be stranded on the road, which is a significant advantage. And at the same time, you can be taking advantage of drawing electricity off of a clean energy grid.
Bottom line, is there a trajectory toward renewable energy that gets us there before the severe dislocation of climate change, some of which we've already seen with Superstorm Sandy and other indicators?
I think one of the tragedies in this country is that we, in a sense, have superabundant energy resources that make us very complacent about making the transition to a renewable energy economy. We've now discovered fracked natural gas as the next panacea, which unfortunately I think is going to set us back very significantly. We're already at 390 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is not sustainable in terms of global warming and climate change. And we're moving in the wrong direction. And unfortunately, the United States is a laggard rather than a leader in coming up with responsible policies to address climate change. Hurricane Sandy should have been warning enough that we have climate instability. We're seeing sea level rise already. We're seeing global temperature rise already. What is it going to take for us to wake up and address this challenge?
And as you point out in the book, back in 73, when you first started working on this issue, 28% of our oil coming from abroad. Today, 60%. Harvest the Wind is the name of the book, America's Journey to Jobs, Energy Independence, and Climate Stability. Philip Warburg recounts his travels around the country to see how wind power is being implemented. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Great to be on your show.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
You can hear more.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.